It's 4:06. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at the wide range of foreign policy challenges facing the Obama administration, from Ukraine to Gaza to Central America.
First, The Book of Life is the highly anticipated final installment of the best-selling All Souls trilogy by author Deborah Harkness. Strung together by a riveting plot involving witches, vampires, and demons, both good and evil, it's a fictional story peppered with touches of true history.
Deborah's book tour passes through Milwaukee on Monday night as she pays a visit to Boswell Book Company. She joins us now to tell us all about The Book of Life. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I just finished The Book of Life. I have to tell you, I'm about 8 hours short of sleep because of it, but I think it was a good trade. How does it feel to have finished this huge trilogy?
It's a little bittersweet, to be honest. It's a wonderful thing to finish out what I set out to do, which was to provide a nice three-book trilogy in a time when many trilogies go to 8 or 9 volumes. But it's also a bit sad to sort of bid farewell to these characters that I've been living with for 5 or 6 years now.
Well, for those of us who haven't read the first two novels, can you catch us up a little bit? You've got the main character, Diana. She's a witch and a Yale historian. And you've got Matthew, her vampire lover and an Oxford biochemist. And they're searching for something called Ashmole 782, otherwise known as the Book of Life. Can you tell us about that? What is it?
Sure. I think of Ashmole 782 as the third main character in the book. And Ashmole 782 is a real missing alchemical manuscript at Oxford's Bodleian Library that I stumbled across when I was doing doctoral research back in the 1990s. And it's always kind of niggled at me in the back of my mind, you know, what might this book contain? So I took that experience as a historian, and I guess I sort of alchemized it into fiction by putting this book at the center of a controversy that exists between the supernatural creatures that surround human beings all the time in their daily life without us really noticing it, which is vampires and demons. And some people think that the Book of Life has the secrets of life in it. Some think that it has the first spells ever written. Some think it has the story of the origin of all species on Earth. And it's our hero and heroine are trying to figure out what is the truth about this volume as they track down its missing pages and try to reclaim it.
Well, you're a historian in real life. Diana is a historian, your main character. How much overlap was there between you and your character?
Diana and I do some of the same things. We both are historians. We both like to row. We both like to ride horses. But at the same time, we're very different. And in fact, most of my main characters have some part of me in them. So Matthew shares my love of wine, and Marcus Whitmore, his son, shares my love of sports cars. So it's all, you know, you kind of get to parcel yourself out among your characters.
Most historians, I imagine, don't go on to write best-selling fantasy series, though. How did that happen for you?
I had finished up my second work of academic nonfiction, and I was on vacation with my family in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and wandered through an airport bookstore and was transfixed by an entire wall of books about supernatural creatures, werewolves, demons, witches, vampires, and I thought to myself, oh my, what happened while I've been in the library for the past 3 years? And I started to play around with the idea that if these creatures really did exist, like my 16th century research subjects thought they did, what would be their kind of struggles and challenges in our modern world? What would they do for a living? How would they date? What would they tell their neighbors? And that's where the story was really born.
It's interesting because it is a new take. There is a lot of vampire fiction out there, supernatural fiction in general, but you don't see so much with this academic bent where it's so much taking place within the walls of universities and with a intellectual thought process behind it. Did you sort of think of this at all ever as a, you know, the intellectual vampire book?
What I really wanted to do was to see if I could, I guess in a way, extend my classroom beyond the walls of the university and to see if I could make the things that I'm really passionate about, which is trying to understand why people in other cultures and in other times do the things they do. If I could make that interesting to a wider audience. And as a historian of science in particular, I'm fascinated with the synergistic links that have always existed between science and magic. And so it was sort of just, it touched on so many of the things that I was interested in that I really wanted to sort of take those ideas out for a spin and just see. Of course, at first I didn't really think anybody but me would ever read it. Maybe my mother was my first reader. But other than that, no one was ever going to read this. So it was a kind of pure pleasure of my own at first.
Well, in addition to writing this fantasy trilogy, you've also authored academic books, and including one on Elizabethan London and the Scientific Revolution. Can you talk a little bit about how your academic work informs and influences your creative work once you've got some of the classroom spilling over into the pages? How do you get the details in there?
Well, I guess in a weird way, I've been researching this All Souls trilogy and the kind of themes in the books since 1982, when I went away to college to be an undergraduate at Mount Holyoke College. And it was there that I really started on the path that led me to becoming an intellectual historian and a historian of science. And what always surprises me is just how hard it is for me still, even as a professional historian, to get all those details right. You know, my academic historians have a very narrow scope of expertise, and so when we veer outside of it, you know, when I'm talking about life in a modern laboratory or when I'm talking about more modern historical themes, it can be a real interesting challenge for me to get it right, and so I'm on a steep learning curve, and I'm a student again, and there's really nothing more exciting than that.
Well, what real-life historical elements did you want to make sure to incorporate into your fictional world?
That's a great question. What I wanted to do was to really try to capture a reality about the past that is more complicated than, wow, they wore funny clothes, and there was no running water and no toilets, which, you know, historians are pretty clear about those things. I wanted to explore what it really felt like to be in the past and what it would have been like to be a modern feminist woman, as Diana is, being plunked in the middle of, you know, the end of the 16th century, where the rules were very different for women and the things we take for granted about being women, being able to be outspoken, being able to work outside the home, were really problematic and could land you in a whole lot of trouble. So often the past is romanticized in fiction or what we see on television or on movies. So I really wanted to have a kind of authentic feel to it based on what I think the past was like.
And you bring some fictional characters who meet real-life people from history. Who pops up in the trilogy from the real world?
Well, the character of Matthew Claremont was actually based on a real Elizabethan poet named Matthew Royden, who is best friends with the likes of Philip Sidney and Christopher Marlowe and Sir Walter Raleigh and Thomas Harriot. And he was a fascinating, enigmatic character that I tripped over when I was working on my master's thesis at Northwestern. And Matthew Royden was a spy for Queen Elizabeth I. And so as a result, like with most spies, we don't really know all that much about him. And this is the great thing about history and fiction, is that where my history runs out, and I can't say anything more really about Matthew Royden because I lack evidence, as a fiction writer I get to make it up. And so that's really fun for me.
Well, there are some loose threads when you get to the end of the trilogy, and among them, what happens to one of my favorite characters, the vampire Galloglass. Do you have any plans to write more about the characters from this world?
Right now, my plan after the tour is to go back into the classroom for spring semester and then use next summer vacation to think of what my next moves will be. I know I have a lot more stories to tell, both nonfiction and fiction, and I'm going to take a little bit of a break before I figure out which one comes next. But I have to say that, you know, Galloglass is sort of large and loud and bossy, so I wouldn't be surprised if he pokes his head up and demands.
Excellent. That's great news. That's what I wanted to hear. Well, Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica. It was a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Deborah Harkness, best-selling author of the All Souls trilogy, and the final book in the series is called The Book of Life. Deborah will be at the Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee on Monday night at 7 p.m. You can find more information at the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
The Obama administration faces a wide variety of foreign policy challenges around the globe. Just today in the news, a ceasefire in Gaza collapsed after a few hours. Fighting continues in Ukraine despite a limited ceasefire. An account of casualties finds over 1,700 people died in fighting in Iraq last month.
And into that mix, the transition of power in Afghanistan, Central American turmoil sending youth to the American border, and tension between China and its neighbors.
So is the Obama administration overwhelmed by these foreign policy problems? Joe Greco joins us now to sort out that question. He's a professor of political science at Duke University, specializing in foreign policy and international relations. Joe, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Rob. It's good to be with you.
So does this convergence of foreign policy problems, do things like this have the potential to overwhelm a president and the administration?
Well, I can understand why we would be concerned about that. It certainly feels very overwhelming for those of us who try to keep up a little bit with the news. I think there would be telltale signs of a foreign policy team that is overwhelmed. For example, overreaction, inability to coordinate with allies. Personally, I don't see that occurring. We're actually beginning to see, for example, in the case of Ukraine, a pretty solid coordination by the United States together with its key European allies, especially Germany, in the imposition of a wider and stronger range of sanctions. That, to me, is a sign of coordination, of good diplomacy, of taking a stand in a way that is reasonable. So some of those something that would say, for example, the United States, on the contrary, were to take a unilateral action, losing support from its European allies, that would suggest dysfunctionality. So I don't think I'm seeing that at present. There are certainly lots of crises.
That leads me to a counter hypothesis I wanted to run past you. Are presidential administrations always dealing with lots of problems like this, but they're only in the public eye now because they're, you know, these conflicts are dramatic enough to get our attention from in the media?
That's an interesting point. It's amazingly hard to be a U.S. president, I would think.
True.
If we were to go back, for example, to the 1980s, we would think of lots and lots of crises occurring simultaneously. Bill Clinton was facing serious problems in East Asia with the Chinese threats against Taiwan at the same time that there was a ongoing civil war in the Balkans. So I think we are seeing a pretty high density. And I'll leave it to my quantitative friends to perhaps try to do a measurement of whether we're in an especially challenging time. It feels like it is, but I think you're right. Presidents have a hard road when it comes to foreign policy. If we think back to wartime presidents, for example, like Roosevelt during World War II, this would not be as difficult a period.
Now, there have been accusations, including Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson talking on this show, that the Obama administration is partly responsible for some of these problems anyway, the attitude being that they could have been trying to, right now they're putting out fires as they happen when they could have been proactive and tried to work to prevent some of these problems in the first place. Is that, and we'll get into some more specifics on the issues in a bit, but is that a fair accusation?
It is a fair hypothesis to entertain, but when we do that sort of assessment, the question will be in connection to these particular cases, say, for example, Ukraine, or let's say, for example, Chinese pressures against Japan in the East China Sea, or pressures against the Philippines in the South China Sea. What exactly is a strong response? Is it military force? We should be very cautious. My own sense would be about unilateral use of force. We don't want to commit suicide for fear of death.
And As far as prioritizing, how does a president decide where to bring the star power out in a way and send the Secretary of State to the region as John Kerry is trying to negotiate the Gaza settlement? How do you pick this is the one we really have to focus the big names on?
I'm sometimes perplexed by this administration's decisions on that score. For example, my own feeling is that if I were to be concerned about a serious war or military conflict involving the United States, I would have thought more attention would be paid to the shoring up and assurance of our Asian allies, in particular Japan, in connection to China, and also making it quite clear to the Chinese that some of their actions are over the line, so to speak. I suspect in the real world of U.S. foreign policy, there are media concerns to which presidents have to respond. The terrible loss of life on both sides in the Gaza war is something that's going to demand attention. But sometimes I wonder if some of the more serious, for the U.S. national interest viewpoint, some of these other issues then get squeezed out, at least temporarily. So that would be my sense about that.
And all these problems, how do we sort out whether this is an American problem threatening American interests versus something maybe we should stand back on, not take a leadership role? Or are we always obliged to try to take a leadership role when there's a conflict around the world?
Well, that latter line of logic would lead to overextension and eventually the United States being able to defend what are really critical interests. And I guess for my part, I would begin with allies. Which allies are having serious challenges? For example, Japan in East Asia or Israel today in the Middle East. Those are, of course, we have very important requirement at this time to reassure Poland and our Baltic allies in NATO that a stand will be taken if needed against Russian probing. So I personally would start with something like that. I of course recognize that as some useful newspaper commentary pointed out, ISIS and its control over territorial parts of Syria and Iraq could produce a new Afghanistan in terms of a haven for terrorists, al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists, who ultimately might try to strike the United States. That is something that requires attention. But I don't know if it requires immediate use of military force.
Well, let's start taking some of these issues in turn and start with ISIS. You say that situation in Iraq and in Syria is not something that military force might be the first answer to. What kind of things can the United States do short of that to try to address the problem?
Yes, I think the two things come to my mind immediately. Number one, diplomacy to try to bring about reconciliation between former Ba'athist party elements among the Sunni population on the one hand and the Shiite-led or dominated government of Prime Minister Malachi on the other. ISIS now enjoys support from many Sunnis, including former Ba'athist military officers, because they fear Malachi more than they fear ISIS. Without that support, I think ISIS wouldn't last very long in Iraq. So therefore, diplomacy to bring about, to split away the Sunni former Ba'athist elements away from ISIS should be a top priority.
And briefly, foreign policy problems bleeding over into each other. We're negotiating with Iran on nuclear talks. Those have been postponed for a while trying to get Iran's help on dealing with what's going on in Iraq.
The United States and Iraq share a common interest in the prevention of ISIS from taking control over a large portion of Iraq. Whether there's actual grounds for communications or sharing of information, that may be possible. But there is a common interest. I don't think, well, and on the other hand, There's also serious conflicts of interest between the United States and several of its allies and Iran regarding its nuclear program. That's going to be probably a constraint on dealing with ISIS.
Foreign policy expert Joe Greco is with us, helping answer the question: with so many foreign policy problems around the world, Gaza and Ukraine, Iraq and Central America, where should the priority be, and is the Obama White House overwhelmed? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with foreign policy expert Joe Greco at Duke University, looking at the long list of problems facing the Obama foreign policy team.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Crises ranging from Ukraine to Gaza, Central America to Iraq. Where should the Obama administration put its priorities? Where should we back off? Maybe it's not our problem. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org. We'll go to Nicholas on the line in Madison now. Nicholas, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Personally, I think the more that we're involved in the Middle East, the worse it gets. I feel like they feel that we're trying to police them and kind of push our beliefs onto them. So I kind of think if we just backed off on them, they wouldn't be so hostile towards us.
Nicholas, thanks for the call. Joe Greco, do you think there's anything to that, to back off and not be so directly engaged in turmoil there in the Middle East?
Well, the United States has been deeply enmeshed in Middle Eastern politics since the 1940s, and it is one of the most complex places on Earth and one of the most difficult places for U.S. foreign policy. I think I share the sense of Nicholas that, and I wouldn't refer to it as backing off or backing away. The United States has an important alliance, congressionally authorized alliance. It's not a formal treaty alliance, but it's a congressionally legal-based alliance with Israel. We also have important ties with Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Turkey. Those relationships are going to stay important. I do think that when I hear some arguments in favor, for example, of more active military support of so-called moderate elements in this Syrian civil war, that's where I begin to have the kind of instincts and inclinations expressed by Nicholas that this could be a step in a wrong direction. So I think nuanced engagement, nuanced and intelligent engagement, which sometimes means we stay out of military conflicts, for example, the civil war in Syria.
It seems like each administration for a number of years now has tried to go in and get a lasting settlement between Israel and the Palestinians. It's the Gordian knot for presidents. Is there any hope that this administration or the next one can actually do that? Do we have that much influence?
Well, that's one of the most tightly drawn Gordian knots, isn't it? There has been progress. Let's remember, there is a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. There is a peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. There has been a proposal by Saudi Arabia some years ago that would envision a settlement, an acceptance of Israel as part of the region. Tremendous change in terms of Saudi Arabia's position. So there has been some progress. However, right now it's pretty clear that due to internal domestic politics in Israel, Israel isn't able to move forward on a two-state solution. It doesn't trust that it can have a secure future with the a weak Palestinian Authority and a hostile Hamas. And I don't know how much the United States can change that calculation for the foreseeable future.
Well, I want to move a ways from there now to an issue that you've mentioned briefly a couple times, one that you're worried is being obscured, overlooked in the midst of all these headlines from everywhere else, conflicts between China and various other neighbors in the China Sea area. That's not something we've been reading a lot about. Can you spell out the basics?
It doesn't get it sometimes hits the front page of the major newspapers, but it's quite rare. China basically claims a great deal of the sea space between itself and its neighbors, extending deep into the South China Sea as well as the East China Sea. There may be the reasons for this might be have to do with possible natural gas and oil resources under the seabed. The problem is that these claims interfere with or contradict the division of the sea space that is envisioned under the 1982 Law of the Seas Agreement. And the Chinese oftentimes do things to, for example, they've just moved a large oil exploration rig into what under any reasonable interpretation is Vietnamese territorial waters. They have created outposts in what, under international legal standards, is pretty clearly Philippine controlled sea space in the South China Sea. There was an incident just last year involving a Chinese naval vessel that cut across the path of a U.S. vessel, reminiscent of some of the near-miss kind of incidents at sea problem that occurred during the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. So, this is an issue, I think, that if I do think there could be an event that would actually involve significant U.S. use of force or the question of the United States use of force, it would be in connection to some of these very close allies of the United States. I'm referring to Japan and the Philippines, not Vietnam.
Well, use of force between the United States and China sounds very, very dangerous. What kind of things would you like to see in U.S. foreign policy to head that off?
Well, I think the strongest thing that can be done is to reassure, is to take actions that persuade the Chinese leadership under President Xi that, in fact, the United States does recognize that and would defend Japan were China to take some of action, for example, to try to occupy islands that are now in which it believes it's in dispute, which are in dispute, but which are under the administrative authority of Japan out there in the East China Sea. So that, I think, is a high priority action. This includes bilateral work with Japan, also perhaps trying to smooth relations, which have been continued to be rocky between Japan and South Korea. There's also an important role to be played by Australia, which I think is interested in working more closely with the United States. There's also another side to the coin. We don't want to be drawn into a conflict between China and Vietnam, and I fear sometimes that Vietnam has a history of tremendous belligerence and willingness to take risks, and would like to draw us into a conflict with China. So both reassurance on the one hand, but also limiting our liability on the other.
Just briefly before we're done, with all these other issues we're talking about, do you think the U.S., the administration, has its eye on the ball on this China issue and is dealing with that along with these other problems?
I think it's doing a reasonably good job. I worry that the Chinese leadership are watching the other areas very closely, and the more they try to draw inferences that might suggest adventurism, the more effort and more explicit the effort, without starting a conflict, but the more reassurance efforts need to be taken, both in connection to Japan, but I'd also accent, I think more reassurance efforts have to be made. Keep an eye on September, the NATO summit. The United States needs to work hard with its allies to reassure Poland and the Baltic countries and send a strong signal to President Putin that Article 5 does apply to those countries.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure, both you. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Veronica.
That's Joe Greco. He's professor of political science at Duke University. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
It's time for our weekly state news roundup. Today we look at the big decisions just handed down by Wisconsin's Supreme Court and find out about a possible coal shortage for the state. Noah Ovshinsky joins us. He's WPR's assistant news director. Hey, Noah.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. Well, it was a big Thursday this week from the state Supreme Court. They tackled three things that have been making headlines in Wisconsin for years now. Let's take them one at a time.
Yeah, three hot-button issues. And you're right. Yesterday was really a huge day in the state Supreme Court. Firstly, the court brought some closure, at least some legal, the closure to some legal debate over Act 10, which was the law that was championed by Governor Walker that curtailed the collective bargaining rights of state unions. The court ruled 5-2 that this controversial law is indeed constitutional.
And who had brought suit or suits on this one?
So the Madison Teachers Union and city workers in Milwaukee originally sued, and they argued that the law basically infringed on their constitutional rights of association, free speech, and equal protection. The majority in the court obviously did not buy that argument.
So what was the argument in the majority turning down that lawsuit?
Right. So the court basically said that the collective bargaining among public unions is something that really is the purview of the state legislature and not something that is somehow, you know, guaranteed or enshrined in the state constitution.
So the suits tried to expand or use the definition from the First Amendment of freedom of association, et cetera, to say that includes what we were doing as unions and collective bargaining. The Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, didn't buy that argument.
No, I mean, the justices basically said, you know, your right to collectively bargain goes only as far as the legislature allows it. Mm-hmm. And of course, in this case, the legislature voted to curtail it.
And so reactions. So there have been a lot in the last day.
Yeah, of course. Governor Walker called it a huge win. Of course, that was one of his signature pieces of legislation in his first term. The attorney for the unions, you know, says while the law was, you know, really meant to eliminate unions, he says they're not going to go away. He says even in light of this recent ruling that unions will, in fact, continue to thrive.
But as you said, there is, in one sense, closure here. This was the last big legal challenge that might have overturned Act 10.
Exactly. So there is some closure. I don't think it closes the door on the issue completely. And what I mean by that is there are still some lawmakers who would like to see the law actually extended to police and firefighters and their unions. You know, now with the law on, you know, solid legal footing, that may be something that the legislature might revisit next year when they come back in session.
Is that something we've heard from Republicans or Democrats on, for that matter?
Senate Republican Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald did not rule it out during an interview yesterday. Assembly Democratic Minority Leader Peter Barca says he actually has no doubt Republicans would expand Act 10 if given the chance.
All right. That's one of three rulings. Moving on to voter ID, another big legal challenge coming before the state Supreme Court.
Yeah. So the second hot-button issue that was dealt with yesterday, and the Supreme Court voted to uphold the state's controversial voter ID law with one, you know, small caveat. The court says the Department of Transportation actually has to find a way to issue photo IDs without a birth certificate. That particular document is, you know, required to receive a free ID, and that costs money. And the court basically said that, you know, voting shouldn't cost any money. You know, the big question is, you know, how will the transportation officials handle that ruling? That's a bit unclear.
Some people are kind of scratching their heads on this one. They didn't overturn it, but they sort of amended how things are enforced in the state to make it comply with the Constitution.
Yeah. I mean, they want to make sure that people who can vote, you know, can, you know, and that money shouldn't be a barrier to them voting.
What do we hear? These were not unanimous. What do we hear from dissenters on this?
No, the court actually ruled in two voter ID cases, and in one the vote was 4-3, and the other, I believe, it was 5-2. The dissenters were, you know, Rob, they were quite direct in their language. And in fact, I'm going to just quote directly from the dissent, and they said, quote, the court follows not James Madison, Jefferson, for whom Wisconsin's capital city is named, but rather Jim Crow, the name typically used to refer to repressive laws used to restrict rights, including the right to vote, of African Americans. So very strong language in the dissent.
And we've heard from Governor Walker on this one as well?
Sure. So Governor Walker also was on the road yesterday and, of course, asked about the rulings. And he called voter ID a common sense reform. And again, it was something that he championed as well.
Primary elections coming up, though. Are we going to show ID at the polls?
No. Even though the state Supreme Court issued its ruling, the voter ID issue is actually far from resolved. A separate federal case has been sent to the appeals court in Chicago. And in the meantime, the law is on hold, essentially. And plaintiffs in that case successfully argued in federal district court that the voter ID law actually violates the Constitution and the Voting Rights Act.
Could that ruling come down in time for November elections?
It's possible. I would say Governor Walker did say he didn't expect voter ID to be in place in time for the November election. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says he will work to get it in place by then. He says these latest rulings in the state Supreme Court actually bolster his case in the federal court. So he says, what happened yesterday certainly could have a direct effect on the federal case that is now sort of winding its way through the federal court system.
Okay. Then the third big issue from the state Supreme Court on domestic partner registries.
Right. So the third hot button issue they dealt with yesterday, the Supreme Court voted to uphold the state's domestic partner registry.
And so give us the background on that law. Where did that come from?
Right. So this registry was set up in 2009 as a way to provide certain benefits to domestic partners like hospital visitation rights.
And what was the challenge to that based on?
The group Wisconsin Family Action sued, and Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen refused to defend the law. Both saw it as sort of a violation of the state's gay marriage ban.
Right. So the ban in the Constitution, the constitutional amendment said there shouldn't be anything created substantially similar, I think words like that,
exactly,
to marriage for same-sex couples. So how did the court read that one?
So the court actually ruled unanimously that this legal status that's set up under this registry, essentially, is not substantially similar to heterosexual marriage and therefore did not violate the gay marriage ban in the state.
And reaction from the people behind that suit?
Julian Appling with Wisconsin Family Action, who brought the suit, said, she was disappointed by the ruling, but at the same time encouraged because the court determined that marriage between a man and a woman is different than the relationships that are included in the registry.
Well, once again, this isn't the end of the story. This is the state Supreme Court. We've got action in federal courts on this.
Right. So just like voter ID, this is also being dealt with in the federal courts. The legal wrangling over the registry and gay marriage in general here in Wisconsin may all actually be for naught. Mm-hmm. That's because the gay marriage ban is currently being challenged in federal court. At the district level, it actually has already been ruled unconstitutional. And, hundreds of couples have already been married in Wisconsin, although those marriages are legally in limbo. An appeals court has taken up the case. But when it's all said and done, this issue will likely end up in the Supreme Court. Wait and see.
Okay. So if the Supreme Court upholds the constitutional ban on same-sex marriage,
right,
then what the state Supreme Court did matters.
Right. So that's in a totally different scenario, assuming the Supreme Court upholds the bans that are in place, nationwide in many states. This ruling could have a lasting effect in Wisconsin because that registry, in effect, would remain in place.
All right. Let's step outside the court now. A possible coal shortage coming up in Wisconsin?
Right. So stepping outside the legal arena here for a second and into the environmental/energy arena. The dramatic increase we've seen in railroad oil shipments around the state, which, of course, we've talked a lot about on the show, is affecting another energy sector. Dairyland Power Cooperative says they have a shortage of coal. Officials say they don't actually have enough to start building the inventory they need for the upcoming winter.
So we've got all this oil coming from the fields in, what, North Dakota, Canada, all the fracking-related stuff. So there's no capacity to carry the coal?
Right. So basically what's happening is these coal shipments are getting bumped by oil shipments coming from North Dakota and Canada. And that means a shortage of coal making its way to some power companies.
A lot of communities in the Midwest rely on coal for electricity.
Yeah. Dairyland, in fact, just Dairyland itself supplies power to something like 40 power plants in four different states.
Well, we can keep shipping coal via rail in the winter, can't we?
Yes, but that's not the problem, at least for Dairyland. The clock is ticking because their coal is shipped by train to the Mississippi River, and then the coal is loaded onto barges bound for their power plant. Of course, the problem is, as soon as the river ice is over, the barges stop running. So the clock is ticking for Dairyland to get the coal they need to get ready for the winter.
So last winter, it was propane costs we were watching. Is it going to be coal this winter?
Well, if things continue on this course, we could see, like the propane shortage last winter, tighter supplies and therefore higher prices.
Are we seeing anything from our electeds on this?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. State Senator Bob Jauch and three other state lawmakers have sent a letter to the Surface Transportation Board urging the feds to take action. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Congressman Ron Kind, they have all weighed in on this issue, trying to get more coal to these power plants.
What could they do? I mean, what can the federal government require be done? And are companies trying to meet this demand?
Right. So the federal government is actually demanding that the railroad, and have sent a letter demanding as much to the railroad, you know, asking, you know, basically every week, you know, every so often, how they're doing and taking care of this backlog of coal. So certainly the feds are very interested in this. Congressman Ron Kind says the railroad has been responsive to their concerns, and that it's trying to speed up delivery. Burlington Northern said in a statement that was quoted by Mike Simonson earlier this week that they are investing billions of dollars to expand capacity. And in the railroad's case, you know, that means, frankly, more people and more locomotives.
How much would capacity have to increase? What does Dairyland say they need?
Well, according to Dairyland Power, the railroad company would have to triple the amount of coal it currently ships every week to avoid, you know, problems down the line this winter.
It's new boom times for freight rail, it seems like.
There is a lot of competition for those railroads. And, you know, the question is, do we have enough capacity to, you know, move grain, to move coal, to move oil?
All right. That'll be one to watch between now and winter. Noah, thanks as always.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Noah Shinsky is WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time to talk state news.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And remember, you can always head over to the Central Time Facebook page to leave your thoughts on what you're hearing on the show. And by the way, head over to WPR.org. Remember that bass conversation we had, the best bass lines, Veronica?
How could I forget?
It was a lot of fun. Well, Eric, one of our web guys, helped me out and put a big playlist, a Spotify playlist of all the bass tracks on there. So go to WPR.org, look up Central Time, find that bass show. There's a lot of great weekend listening waiting for you over there. So, a lot of fun. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time here in the Ideas Network.